One of the things that we talk about in Buddhism is that there is suffering, but there's also the end of suffering and the path that leads to the end of suffering.
Welcome to Show Up or Shut Up with Wendy Solganic, also known as Willa.Wanders on Instagram. This podcast features real and raw conversation about the lives of prolific makers. What is really happening behind all of those gorgeous photos of art on Instagram? How we came to be prolific makers? What makes us consistently show up? And the very real challenges that we all face. This episode of Show Up or Shut Up is brought to you by the Willa Workshops, found at willawanders.com. Take a class in how to make your own Willa journals, have fun with a secret tag book, or enroll in our year-long mixed media art experience, Fodder School. These and many more outstanding courses are available right now at willawanders.com.
Hello.
Hello, Karen. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's my honor and privilege to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. I'm going to do an introduction. It is off the cuff. It is totally spontaneous. This was not a pre-planned podcast episode. I'm having a conversation with my best friend, Karen, and we're talking about something so deep and meaningful about creativity that I said, hey, can we just record this for my podcast? So Karen and I have been friends for 22 years, and we met as relatively new mommies in Los Angeles, and we quickly discovered that we had a lot in common. And one of the things that we had in common was that we both loved paper crafting. And so we started getting together pretty regularly to do scrapbooking. And not that long after we met, I actually moved away from Los Angeles and I moved to Cleveland, Ohio. And our crafting together days ended. And after 22 years, we are back together. And now we are long distance crafting together. So Karen, fill me in on where you've been in the last 22 years as far as your art practice goes.
So I've had two kids, and then my husband passed away, and I was working full time and raising my kids on my own. And so I didn't have much time for crafting. I would squeeze in little projects here and there, but it wasn't a full-time, full-fledged art practice. It was more a catch-as-catch-can, do some scrapbooking or some needlepointing or crocheting or drawing or bookmaking, but just a little bit here and there. About 5 years ago, I got really into writing, and I started a daily writing practice, and I went on a writing retreat in a Buddhist tradition. I've been a practicing Buddhist in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh since 1993, and so along with my Buddhist practice, I've been doing a writing practice. And I went on a Buddhist retreat in Santa Fe and started a writing group. So for the past 5 years, I've been in a writing group and we've been writing together. And so the focus of my creative juices, maybe for the last 5 years, has been on writing. And then about 6 months ago, I felt like I had done what I wanted to do with my writing, and I started to come back to my art practice. And Wendy encouraged me to check out Fodder School, which I did. And I've just become a passionate Fodder School student and am loving being able to spend my days working on my art. I'm retired now. And so, and my kids are home because of the pandemic, but they're adults now. And so I have more time to devote to my art.
So you've always been a paper crafter. That's always been, I remember you making books and going and taking bookmaking courses locally in Los Angeles.
Yes.
So you're not someone who's coming at, you know, paper crafting 6 months ago, never having had any experience. You actually,
right.
I remember
right.
you even used to do like art collage.
That's right. I actually did a lot of art as a kid and a teenager, and I studied art at a local art school as a teenager, and I did a lot of art in college. I didn't major in art, but I did take studio art classes and did ceramics and continued taking art courses and painting and drawing and doing paper crafts, you know, throughout my early adult years. And I even had a little burgeoning kind of art. I don't know what to say. I started exhibiting some of my artwork and showing some of my artwork locally and selling some of my artwork. And that was really exciting and fun. And then I ended up having kids, and it was just impossible to keep working and raising kids and being a married person and have that time and space to make art. So when we met, yeah, we were doing some crafting stuff on the side, but it wasn't a full-time thing.
Definitely not, because we were taking care of babies. Now,
but we went and did watercoloring one afternoon at, I don't know, was it Huntington Gardens or someplace?
Oh, yes, probably.
And we took a bookmaking, card making class at Wild Fiber. And yeah, we did a lot of scrapbooking. We spent a lot of our time scrapbooking.
We did. So one thing that I think it's important that people understand about you and why I want to have this conversation with you is that you actually have a PhD in psychology, psychotherapy. What do you call it? PhD in psychology?
Yeah, that's right.
And you were a practicing psychotherapist for 30 years, 35
yeah.
years. So
yeah.
for quite a long time. So
yeah.
something that I just keep talking to people about, and people keep asking me this question, is why do you make the kind of art you make? They will say, you know, that maybe they'll find me on Instagram or something, and they'll say, I just don't understand. Why do you make this? I'm not saying every day people ask me this, but they ask it enough. And my answer is always the same, which is primarily I make this kind of art because I like the way that I feel when I make this kind of art. And I always say it makes me feel very calm. And I get this, you know, this flow state effect. And I was just hoping that you could explain a little bit more, both from a psychological perspective, but also from your Buddhist traditions perspective of why human beings might be drawn to a practice like, you know, a mixed media art practice surrounding, you know, collage fodder and projects made with collage fodder. Like, why is this so attractive to so many people, do you think, in your opinion?
Well, one thing we were talking about earlier is that I just got back from a mindfulness and creativity retreat. And it was really exciting and wonderful because I have been practicing mindfulness, meditation, and living in a mindful way all these years. And this was a retreat in my particular Buddhist denomination, the Plum Village Community of Engaged Buddhism. and creativity. And it wasn't just paper crafts. It was music. It was dance. It was writing. It was mixed media, painting, stitching, and some paper arts. So it was a combination of a lot of different workshops. But the overriding theme had to do with mindfulness and how we can basically heal ourselves and find happiness and peace through practicing mindfulness, and in this case, mindful creativity. So I think that, you know, one of the things that I really appreciated about the retreat was there was this emphasis on the fact that when we're living in the present moment, we can enjoy all the conditions that are there to support us in our life. And that's not to say that we don't have unhappiness, loss, death, sickness, old age. We have all those things. But there are also a lot of really wonderful things that are going on each moment as well that sometimes we just take for granted, like I'm breathing, or I don't have a toothache today, or, you know, the sun is out and it's, you know, t-shirt weather here in Southern California, and what a joy that is. Or the flowers are blooming and the bees are, you know, flying from flower to flower, just all these small things that are conditions of happiness are there all the time. But if we're not paying attention to them, we miss them. And so part of having a mindful creative practice is that we can, I'm not saying everyone does do this, but we can be in the present moment and not worrying about the past and not worrying about the future and perhaps not thinking about our anger or our greed or our wrong views. We can let go of notions and be more in what you're referring to as a flow state, or what I might call in the present moment. So that's one piece of it. I could say more, but I'm going to stop there and see if you have any specific questions about that.
Well, I do have one question. It surrounds my conception of flow state, I think, and whether or not I'm truly in flow state, because I have a little bit of what I'm going to call a guilty pleasure. And that is that I multitask. And, or I don't even know if it's considered multitasking, because it doesn't require really much of anything on my part, but I do like to listen to books on audio or a podcast while I cut paper and glue paper and tear paper. And it is a little bit like a magic pill for me, where when I'm doing the two things in conjunction, I am not thinking about the past. I'm not thinking about the future. I feel like I'm in that moment. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm misjudging where I'm at, because maybe where I'm really at is somewhere else. I don't really know. So what are your thoughts on the multitasking influence on the mindfulness practice?
Well, I guess I can only speak from my own experience, but for me, I like to monotask and I like to try to focus my attention on one thing. And this is also part of my training as a student of Thich Nhat Hanh, is to do one thing at a time and to be in the moment with that one thing. So if we're really strictly practicing, you know, let's say we're walking with somebody, we wouldn't be walking and talking. We would be walking and paying attention to our walking. And if we're going to talk, we would stop walking and give our 100% attention to talking to who we're with. So for me, part of the mindfulness practice is to be aware of what's going on in our mind when we're creating, because our mind is often doing a lot of stuff, like even when we're meditating. The idea isn't that we're just going to be blissed out meditating or praying and not be thinking anything. We're more tuning into what's really there. In this way of practicing mindfulness, there are a lot of different ways of practicing. I'm just really talking about the Plum Village way. So what I heard at the retreat that I really appreciated was that when we make space for everything that's going on in our mind, whether we're putting ourselves down or putting ourselves up or worrying about something or thinking a sad thought about something, just making space for all of that, accepting all of that, loving everything as it is, not trying to push things away, not trying to have it be any different than what it is part of what leads us to heal and to feel free. Because when we see that all our thoughts and feelings are impermanent, we realize that everything comes and goes. And that these thoughts that I'm having right now are just going to be some other thoughts in the next minute. And that we don't have to build a monument to them, as my teacher Larry Ward would say. We don't have to get stuck in them or even believe them. So, you know, one of the things that the Buddha talked about is that our notions, our ideas are what lead us to suffering. And so part of mindfulness practice is seeing our notions, seeing our ideas, seeing that a lot of our notions and ideas are actually incorrect or false. And that can actually lead us to a lot of freedom. So one of the biggest notions that leads to a lot of suffering is the notion that I am a separate self. And everybody else is separate, and none of us are connected. And that's considered a false notion. The truth of reality, as the Buddha taught it, is that we're all interdependent. We all inter-are. And that nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything is part of everything else. And that when we can see that, we can see that we're the same as everybody. We are made of the same stuff. And not only as every other person, but as everything. You know, one of my projects, I used the elements table of chemical elements, because those chemical elements are the building blocks of all known life and inorganic matter on our planet. And we're all made of the same stuff. And so when we can embrace that in ourselves, we can overcome a lot of things that cause us suffering. So I thought I was going to be talking more about art, and I hope this isn't too heavy on the Buddhism, but I'm trying to talk about how mindfulness, using mindfulness along with a creative practice, can actually be very healing and liberating for us.
Well, I really appreciate this, because I think that the first thing you touched upon was, you know, that all humans are suffering, or that we've all suffered at times in our lives. And I definitely know that the practice of creation, you know, whatever it is you're doing, writing or paper crafts, scrapbooking, anything, is a way to relieve that feeling of suffering. So I think for me personally, I use the combination also as a way to relieve my own suffering. It's a different path. So I use that combination of listening and crafting to heal myself, to relieve my suffering. And you're presenting a very different way. It's not like I never craft without something on. I oftentimes go into my studio and I find that I just start crafting. And after an hour, I'm like, oh my gosh, isn't that so interesting? Like, I never turned on the radio. I never turned on a podcast. And I was just in here crafting. But the element that I'm not doing when I'm just crafting in silence is I'm not watching my thoughts. Like I'm not aware, consciously aware of the thoughts that just, the monkey mind, the thoughts that just continue to roll on by. So that's an interesting thing that I could add to my creative practice is just deciding I'm going to do a creative meditation. I'm going to do this in silence and I'm going to just see what thoughts come up, you know, and I'm not, so I've tried straight up meditation, you know, where I sit in a posture and I meditate for 15 minutes and it's not something that sustains me the way that creativity sustains me. So I'm really happy that I did find creativity to bring me that peace and calm and healing that I so desperately needed. So I think I've talked about this on other people's podcasts. I'm not totally sure I've ever talked about this on my own podcast, but I had an eating disorder for most of my life. And when I came back to my own creativity, what is the most striking thing about it is the level of healing that I've been able to achieve from my own biggest suffering in my life. So can you talk a little bit more about human suffering and how using mindfulness and meditation and creative meditations helps to alleviate suffering?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. That's something that we've shared over the years is that I've had disordered eating and an eating disorder as well. And, you know, I have found also a lot of healing through my writing and through my art practice. You know, one of the things that we talk about in Buddhism is that there is suffering, but there's also the end of suffering and the path that leads to the end of suffering. And so there are things that we as humans do that make ourselves suffer, and there are things we can do that can alleviate suffering. And so I'm just thinking about how to frame this. So for example, one thing we can do to make ourselves suffer is to judge ourselves very harshly. And we could be judging ourselves while we're doing our art. We could say, this isn't good. This isn't as good as so-and-so. I'm no good at this. I'm not really an artist. I can't figure this out. And that would be called an inferiority complex. We're comparing ourselves to others. There's also a superiority complex where we could be saying, I'm so great, I'm awesome, I'm the best person who ever did this paper craft in the world, I'm fantastic, everybody else sucks. And that could actually cause us suffering as well. And the third complex is the equality complex, is that everybody's just exactly the same. There's no difference. Everybody's the same. We're all equal. We're all equally good. We're all equally bad. We're all equally equal. So the way that, you know, mindfulness would come to play in this is that if we start playing one of those tapes, let's say, or CDs in our head, we could say, oh, wow, I'm putting myself down about this project. This is not helping me to be in flow state. This is not helping me to, you know, problem solve or figure out if this is any good or any bad, or even if it is good or is bad, it doesn't even matter. The important thing is just doing it. And we're not going to love every single thing that we do. And there's nothing wrong with that. So to look at it as a process that, like, I'm enjoying doing my art and I don't need to be making something for some other reason necessarily. I can just be doing this for the process of the enjoyment and the self-expression and the self-knowledge and the self-growth. So that's one thing. Another thing is that, you know, I've heard people talk, and I think that this was true for me too, when my husband died, about like using art to heal ourselves, that when we've been through trauma, and I really believe that all of us have been through a lot of trauma, that we can heal ourselves by processing that trauma, creating things out of that trauma, expressing that, expressing ourselves, turning something maybe that was really difficult into something that's beautiful or an expression of our heart. And that's really very healing when we have a loss or when we're going through something. Taking time to nourish ourselves through creative practice can be very healing.
That's, you know, fascinating, because until you just said this right now, I think on some level I recognized that all of what I've been doing with my art in the last 4 to 5 years is a processing of my own personal trauma. And the result of that is everything that I have created, that is, you know, what is the Willa workshops and Willa wanders and all of that stuff. And as you were just talking about, you know, how the processing of trauma and creating something can actually result in something much larger than that trauma and much greater, that's what I see when I look at what I've done. I mean, I don't know if people recognize that that's what this all is, but it's all a processing of deep trauma.
That's so interesting. Yeah, because we all have all these skills and talents and beautiful qualities. And even though we go through trauma and loss, and in my case, I'm raising a child with special needs, and have had just different difficulties throughout my life, we develop a lot of resilience and skills, and those things have a lot of value as well. And we can put that into our art. And, you know, also what I've noticed is that the act of doing art can really regulate our nervous systems. You know, being engaged, whether we're listening to a podcast or not, being engaged in a kind of mindful activity, whether it's singing or humming or exercising or making art, when we are giving something our concentration, we are actually in a kind of a healing place for our nervous system. And there's a lot of talk lately in the psychological and in the mindfulness communities about the vagus nerve and how our vagus nerve reacts to the fight and flight things that are going on in our world and puts us into like a hyper alert state where we are, you know, preparing to fight or flee or freeze. But when we're in a calm state, our vagal nerve, you know, gets the message and sends the message to our whole body that we can relax and we're safe and we are happy and we are okay in that moment. And so the more I think that we do our art practice, the more I think we're toning our vagal nerve and teaching it to be in a resilient zone where we feel less thrown off by, you know, the vicissitudes of the world these days. Not to say that we're burying our head in the sand. I mean, we're aware of all the horrible things that are happening to our Mother Earth and other people and the planet, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, the more joy and happiness we can generate in our own lives, the more we become a source of that kind of joy and happiness and resilience in the world, and the more we can share that with others.
That was so profound. I what you just described is what I have been thinking for months or years, even, that no matter what is going on in the world, and like you said, I don't have my head in the sand. I'm very aware of the things that are going on, but my internal peace and calm, my internal stability, I mean, I went through taking care of my mother at the end of her life and, you know, having her pass away, transition in our home. And my internal stability was never really rocked. And all of the other things that are continuously going on, because there isn't really a day in the week that goes by that I don't spend a decent amount of time just in that creative place where I am getting that feeling of just complete calm. And so no matter what happens around me, like, I'm a happy, calm person. Pretty much. Not 100%, but like probably way more than I've ever felt in my life. And I just kind of thought like, oh, this is what happens when you age. You just become a more peaceful person. But now that you're describing it, I think it's the art practice.
And I just want to make a little side note here, and which is something that I shared when I was at the retreat, is that I don't see mindfulness or meditation or even a spiritual or religious practice or an art practice for that matter as a panacea. Those things aren't going to heal and solve every problem that every person has in their lives. You know, we, myself included, suffer from depression. We have anxiety. We have loss. We have death. We have, you know, difficulties. And these things are real. And sometimes we do need to seek professional help or technologies that are proven to, you know, help people with anxiety or depression. So don't think that you're doing something wrong if, you know, you're having a depression or an anxiety or a situation that your art practice or your spiritual practice aren't alleviating. I mean, these things are very real.
Thank you for saying that. That is so important to say. I would never want to lead someone to believe that just by having an art practice, it means it's like a cure-all. And I've been a big, actually, fighter of that notion that, you know, making art every day is like the end all be all and cures all things. And, you know, that leads to a lot of guilt I've seen for other people, where if they can't make art every day or they don't feel like making art every day, that they end up having this tremendous amount of guilt because they hear how healing an art practice is. So they end up like, it's almost like it has the reverse effect where they think it's, you know, supposed to be a cure-all, and then they know they're not doing it every day. So they feel very bad about not doing it every day. And I mean, I have a whole group on Facebook where I try to basically dispel that notion.
The same is true in the mindfulness community. People can think like, I'm meditating every day, I'm practicing, you know, I think I'm practicing correctly, but I'm still depressed. What's wrong with me? What am I doing wrong? And the truth is that, you know, sometimes depression is a neurochemical thing, and sometimes it's related to trauma, and sometimes it's passed down through, you know, generations. In my case, you know, there's a long family history of depression. And so, you know, no matter how correctly I practice mindfulness, I still need, you know, assistance with my, you know, neurochemical problem. And that's not because I'm not practicing correctly or doing my art correctly.
Oh, I really appreciate you saying that, because, you know, I can only speak from my experience, and because I don't have a neurochemical imbalance, it's easier probably for me to say, oh, this art practice just, you know, makes me happy, but I'm not also struggling with the other issues that a lot of people struggle with.
Right.
So I really, really, really appreciate you saying that. So you touched on something before, these three common thoughts that people have about, you know, I'm not, this art isn't good enough. I'm not good enough as an artist, or I'm so great as an artist, or everyone is the same as an artist. Can you elaborate just a little bit more before we end this conversation today about why that's important for people to be aware of? Because people definitely are aware of these thoughts. I mean, this is something that's commonly talked about in the art community and in that Facebook group that I have, the Conscious Creativity for Mixed Media Artists, where people will come in and they'll say, I just don't feel like I'm good enough as an artist. No, nobody says I feel like I'm the best artist out there. Everyone is really coming, you know, with other thoughts, a lot of other thoughts.
It's hard for us to believe this, I think, but there is no wrong color. There's no wrong shape. There's no wrong arrangement or composition. I mean, we're trained to think that certain things are beautiful and certain things aren't beautiful, but the truth is that it's just different colors and shapes and arrangements. And, you know, what I think is helpful for the creative process is just to say to ourselves that I'm just creating and it's okay. And if I have these voices telling me I'm not good enough or this isn't beautiful, it's okay. It's okay if we think that, but we can kind of treat ourselves like we're a child that we want to nurture and support. Like if our child maybe said that to us, we might say, oh, I love everything you do. No mark is wrong. No color is wrong. No choice is wrong. And so I think we want to just come at ourselves as much as possible with that same kind of like good parent attitude. Like even if we don't have that instinctual voice, just to try to develop it in ourselves, like, just try it, just see what happens. You can throw it away. It's no big deal. Just see, because sometimes, you know, you really need to experiment to find something, or sometimes, you know, things aren't working out and you need to do some problem solving. And that can be really fun when you find a solution to some kind of creative problem. And that's just kind of part of the process. So I think those complexes get in the way of like our flow and our letting ourselves explore and have this be an exploration. At this workshop, I taught a little course on small format collages, and I provided people with a little kit of materials that they could used to make collages, and most of them hadn't done collage before. And it was really cool because, you know, I had an idea of what people would do. And I have a lot of ideas based on being a fodder school student on what, you know, these little collages could look like. But some people just really took it out of the box, like way, way, way out of the box, building sculptures and adding, you know, the little I gave them circular substrates and making little ladybugs out of the circles and making inchworms and creating sculptures using pieces of wood. And it was like, it was so exciting and it was so joyful. Like, it just doesn't have to be one thing. It doesn't have to be anything. It can be whatever your heart is telling you. One of the students took the circles and they made like a little sculpture folding the circles so that there were like four circles all touching in the middle, kind of like a Christmas ornament where it was like a flower. And then she put a little plastic bottle cap under it and it could spin on there and decorated each of the little compartments. And it was just like so outside the box. I just loved it. And, you know, and so we don't want our, you know, inner critic to say, oh no, that's not the assignment, or no, oh no, don't do that. just do it, just go for it. You know, that's, I think that's part of how we free ourselves from those complexes.
So something that you said brought up something that I think a lot about, which is the, like, people come at these practices from very different needs that they're looking to fulfill inside of themselves. So some people have a need to have, you know, at the end of the project that they're working on, they have a strong desire to express themselves artistically in that final piece. Like, you know, whether it's them looking at it or someone else, that they want to feel like they have expressed something important within themselves that needs to be expressed. And I come at the whole entire experience very, very differently. And I think that on a basic level, I don't have the quote unquote artist personality type, because where I come at all of this creativity and all of this making is I just really like the way that the scissor feels in my hand as it cuts through the paper. And I like the way that the water and the pigment feel as I'm swooshing my paintbrush around on my palette. And then the way that it feels when I'm, you know, taking my paintbrush and I'm running it across the watercolor paper, or with like the jelly plate. I love the way it feels to squeeze the paint onto the plate and then to take the brayer and just carefully just roll that paint on. And it's like, whatever happens, I don't really care. Like, I'm not looking for a specific result. I'm not going to say I don't enjoy what I make because it makes me happy, but ultimately what I just really like is the feeling of the materials in my hand. It's why I was a potter all those years ago when you first met me. I mean, I just liked the way the clay felt in my hands and the water. So this is
my thought, and I think this is a little bit radical, and I hope it won't offend you or your listeners, but I think that part of the problem with our culture is the way that people and things are commodified, and that the capitalism puts this value on everything. And because we grow up in this culture, we can't help but sometimes get caught up in that whole mindset. Like, what is this good for? What is this worth? What is the value on this? And, you know, when I just let go of thinking about my art that way, it just helped me to feel a lot freer and just to enjoy the doing of it. I don't need to sell it. I don't need to do anything with it. Actually, what I really love about this month's Fodder School lesson is the idea of giving our art away and using our art to uplift other people in difficult situations. The whole lesson on Fodder the World is just so beautiful, because we can have fun making our art, and then we can give our art as a gift that can inspire and make other people feel good and feel seen and feel valued and feel cared for. And it becomes an interaction. It's not a commodification. We're not selling it. We're not buying it. We're giving it. We're doing these random acts of kindness. So I kind of lost my train of thought there, but.
Well, that's a really important thing, because Fodder School and the type of art that I found myself ultimately being just very satisfied making is not something that I am in any way trying to commodify. Now, of course, I'm a business person and I bring this experience to people, and that experience is commodified, but the art itself is not commodified. I don't make things and then put them on Etsy at this point. I'm not trying to sell fodder. I just like the experience and the sharing of it. I mean, definitely the experience will take you pretty far. But then I think, you know, there is a turning point where you're like, I want to give this away.
And I think one of the really beautiful things of fodder school that you didn't plan, but that has really happened, is the community that's developed among the students through the Facebook group and through, especially through the artist trading card share game that some people participated in. Just this idea that we're, you know, sharing our struggles, sharing our learning, sharing our ideas, getting to know other people who enjoy doing the things that we're doing all over the world. And that has been a really beautiful connection and interbeing of all these artists that, you know, really money can't buy that kind of feeling of connection and heart to heart.
Wow, what a point to come to, because I think we started this conversation possibly talking about how nothing, you know, nothing is disconnected. Everything is connected. And you brought up this point about how there is this like interconnectedness of the people who are in the school and how we trade things and mail each other things and communicate in the Facebook group. And I just think that there is something so profoundly important about what we're doing. And I don't want to like toot my horn or toot our horns too much, but I often think about this idea, and I'll probably cry when I talk about it, but like we've spent our whole lives like warring with other cultures and ourselves. And it's like, when you connect with people around the world, like how could you be at war with the people that you connect with all over the world? And like my big, crazy, like hairy dream is to connect as many people as possible to create as much peace as possible in the world. Like do my little tiny part. And I'm not out there to like make really great art or like teach anyone any like great art skill. I'm not someone who's like, you know, oh my God, I'm going to teach you like the most magical thing kind of a person. Or I'm going to be the greatest artist that ever lived. And I want to have like my art, you know, in museums or on walls. But if I could like connect the most people that I could possibly connect in peace, like I would just die a really happy person.
Well, I think you're doing it, and I think you've done it. So it's awesome.
You're such a therapist.
Well, I have the same hope, you know, to bring some kind of little peace and joy to my corner of the world. You know, I'm not going to be a huge personality that makes big differences in millions of people's lives. But if I could touch a few people and help them have a better life and more peace and more liberation and more happiness and more, inner peace and freedom, then I think that's a huge gift.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate you coming on my podcast on extremely short notice. And I think that we have touched on some of the most important things that we are doing just as individuals and collectively as a group, and why we do fodder school and what it means for people. I mean, I do get met a lot of emails where people say like fodder school is about way more than these projects that we're doing. And I think that it's just an organic thing. I don't have some kind of like, you know, grand plan for all of the things that end up happening. It just does happen organically. And I think that a lot of people are feeling this same kind of way about it. It just, it's a cool thing. So,
well, I think the community of practice is really, really valuable. The Buddha said that having good spiritual friends is 100% of the practice. And
wow.
I think you've really created a beautiful, very accepting, very welcoming, very nurturing community of art practitioners, and that, you know, we support and learn from each other and feel connected even through, you know, time and space. So it's really beautiful.
All right, Karen, this is probably a part one of who knows how many parts of a conversation about inner peace and mindfulness and creativity. So I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today, and I hope that we record again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Show Up or Shut Up with Wendy Solganic. If you've made some art or craft while you listened, take a photo of it, post it to Instagram, and tag me at willa.wanders so I can see what you were up to. And if you feel like what we talked about here spoke to you today, please hit the subscribe button so that you will be the first to know about new episodes of this podcast. Have a wonderful day. Go create something, anything, and I hope you find your flow.